Good morning, Oregon, and thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Audio Edition podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Every weekday except Thursday, that is. Today's Thursday. Thursdays are the day we do something a little bit different. On this particular Thursday, we're going to be continuing to read from the lost chapter from my book, Wicked Portland, the Wild and Lusty Underworld of a Frontier Seaport Town. This is the chapter that would not fit in the book, and so I published it online under a Creative Commons license, and I can't read you from my book unless I get permission from the publisher to whom I signed over the rights to it. But I can read you from this because it's still mine. And you might remember last Thursday we read the first half of it. We talked about the situation that led up to the ladies coming together in the church, into the church, and forming an interdenominational group of Victorian ladies that were going to work as best they could to end this mighty and terrible social evil that they were seeing all around them, which was the abuse of alcohol. And they had just reached the conclusion that they weren't going to get anywhere by praying in church and inviting drinkers to come to church with them. They were going to have to take their operation out into the streets, as I put it towards the end of yesterday's reading, in the only way that their society would allow them to do so, with a prayer and a song and a fabulous but slightly ridiculous hat. And so that brings us to where we are today, in which the ladies are leaving the church and two by two fanning out across Portland. Here we go. The ladies' modus operandi was simple. They would present themselves at the saloon and ask the proprietor if they might enter and give a prayer and a song for the sots within. Most of the time the answer was yes. That would change later. But at this early stage, they had little trouble. If the saloon keeper offered them a complimentary drink, which more than one did, they would graciously decline. Then they'd pray and sing a hymn or two and circulate a pledge for the drunks to sign promising to abstain from alcohol, and then sing and pray some more, and then leave. For a Victorian-era lady, this was nowhere near as easy as it sounds to the modern ear. Laura Frances Kelly, one of the temperance crusaders, wrote a handwritten account of how that went. Quote, "Can you imagine what it would be to go into a saloon to pray? Then you can imagine how we felt. I cannot tell you. The saloon keeper received us cordially, ushering us into the card room. As the song rose from trembling hearts, Holy Spirit, faithful guide, ever near the Christian's side, etc., the barroom quickly filled with young men to whom the barkeeper freely dispensed his liquors. As we knelt in prayer, the clink of glasses well nigh drowned out the petitions that rose from trembling lips. When the short service was over, the barkeeper invited us very pleasantly to come again. Oh, how we hastened back to church and kindred spirits! But the pastor, George W. Iser, met us with, 'Back so soon? Did you visit only one saloon?' Then we saw what was before us." At the end of the day, they were exhausted and demoralized. Their reception everywhere had been gracious and welcoming, but at least part of the reason for that was the spike in liquor trade which they inspired. The presence of two respectable Victorian-era ladies in their Sunday best, singing and praying and pleading for temperance, was a show that packed in the crowds. It was like having a circus act in the pub. True, the ladies were treated courteously everywhere, with the Portland Daily Bulletin sniffed, the notable exception of, quote, "the proprietress of a low doggery on Second Street." But the courteous treatment mostly took the form of that peculiar variety of chivalrously benevolent condescension, which men once used as a passive-aggressive rhetorical weapon against women. Perhaps thinking the, quote, "fairer sex" too stupid to understand they were being made fun of, these men drank toasts to the success of the Great Crusade and made a great show of gallantry as they signed fictitious names to the abstinence pledge. And they kept right on drinking. Back in the church, the ladies prayed for strength and then went home for the night. The next day, things were a little different. Someone, it's not clear who, suggested that rather than fanning out across the city, the ladies should all go in a group, all 13 of them would pay a call on a single saloon. This would have several advantages. First, they'd have each other to lean on and would not feel so alone in a crowded sea of men who, although careful to appear chivalrous, were clearly hostile to what they were trying to do. Second, they'd have more volume during the hymn singing part to drown out the clink of glasses. And thirdly, with 13 ladies in the saloon, the chances of a customer knowing one of them was exponentially greater. Nobody was going to jeer at his aunt-in-law or his boss's sister. The ladies fortified themselves with a lengthy prayer service and then poured once again out of the church. Today, they descended upon the Mount Hood Saloon, owned by a chap named Thomas Shartle. By all accounts, Mr. Shartle was a good egg and let them in and let them have the run of the place. Mr. Shartle did not, however, turn off the taps and was probably glad he did not. If two Victorian ladies in a saloon was like a circus act, then 13 of them was like the whole circus. People poured into the Mount Hood. On the surface, it looked like a repeat of the previous day's disaster, only on a bigger scale. Mr. Shartle sold an enormous volume of alcoholic beverages that day. The ladies got the same faux-hearty, "Best of luck to ya, God bless ya, here's to ya," response from the same saloon bums and fielded the same fake signatures on the temperance pledge. But somehow it was different. The ladies moved on, going down market a bit and visiting a rum house called the Evening Call. Again, they brought the proprietor plenty of business and left with very few legitimate pledges. Back at the church, the ladies learned word had gotten around the saloons that their presence represented a huge business boom. One saloon owner actually sent them an invitation to come to his place, which to his delight they did the next day. But the sense of demoralization was utterly gone. The ladies knew they were onto something. They started going out every day, each day to a different saloon. And slowly, things started to change. The upscale Orofino, partly owned by Portland Police Chief James Lapius, whom we will get to know better in a bit, as promised last week, was the first establishment to put its money where its gallant mouth was and shut down its taps during the ladies' visit there. There was still a healthy crowd, but the Orofino sold them no drinks until the ladies finished up their service and left. With this example set, the better saloon keepers found themselves pressured to do likewise, which dramatically reduced their incentive to have the ladies over for the afternoon. And even in the pubs that ignored the Orofino's example, the money-making magic was fading fast. The crowd of idle, thirsty spectators that had once followed the ladies around from tavern to tavern had dwindled away until it included only the idlest and the thirstiest. After a week or so, the Crusaders' arrival at a saloon stopped being an attractant. At the same time, the number of ladies participating in the raids swelled. Soon their arrival meant not a lucrative afternoon of pouring drinks and collecting coin, but the effective shutting down of the bar for as long as the ladies chose to stay. More and more saloon keepers began refusing to let the ladies come in. At first when this happened, they'd move on, but soon, inspired by the actions of Walter Moffat, more on that in a minute, they changed their tactics. When refused admission to a saloon, they'd stand in front of it on the sidewalk and hold a prayer and song service right there. This was actually worse, because it was like a picket line that customers would have to cross publicly if they wanted to enter the saloon. It also made a public spectacle of the barkeeper's lack of hospitality. Tensions were on the rise as the month of April wore on. On April 14th, at a saloon in the North End, a proprietress slammed the door in the Crusaders' faces and the wind blew it back open again, quote, "She rushed to the door and poured a volley of abuse upon us," according to the handwritten account of one anonymous temperance worker. But there were some successes, too. That same handwritten account goes on, quote, "Evening Call Saloon closed. Proprietor signed the pledge." You'll remember the Evening Call as the rum shop visit on the first day of the crusade after they left Thomas Shartle's Mount Hood. Well, by the middle of April, the warring parties had settled into an uneasy sort of relationship in which the saloon keepers tried to keep as low a profile as possible. Trying, if you'll pardon the anachronism of using a metaphor 100 years before its time, trying to stay off the ladies' radar. Well, most of them did. There was one exception. Walter Moffat was one of Portland's most respected men, and by most accounts a decent guy. A Brit by birth, he went to sea as a young man and did well for himself. By the time he arrived in Portland, he was a ship captain. He settled down in Portland and married well. His wife was from a family called Terwilliger, a name you'll instantly recognize if you've ever lived in Portland. By the time he'd settled down in Portland, he was a man of property, owning several shipping interests as well as two saloons. the Tom Thumb, and the Webfoot. It was the Webfoot Saloon that was to be ground zero in Portland's temperance riots. Because amiable and respectable though Mr. Moffat might have appeared, it turned out he had very little patience for temperance workers. The Webfoot was located on the northwest corner of First and Morrison, just off the waterfront at its more respectable southern end. How the hostilities between Moffat and the temperance crusaders got started is unclear. There are two very different accounts of the action. One comes from the Portland Daily Telegraph. Another one comes from author and journalist Francis Fuller Victor's little book, published later that year. Both accounts agree that Moffat first met two of the temperance workers on that ill-starred day when they were fanning out across the city two by two. That's all they agree on. The Bulletin story the next morning says Mr. Moffat greeted them courteously but declined to let them enter his bar. Fuller Victor, however, describes the action somewhat differently. Quote, "The two ladies, trembling but full of holy zeal, paused at the entrance on Morrison Street and stepped into the saloon, whose proprietor was as unknown to them as the proprietors of other saloons. As they entered, Mr. Moffat, on the alert, entered by the front street door, which brought him face to face with his visitors. Without giving them time to announce their errand, he seized each rudely by an arm and thrust them out into the street, exclaiming, 'Get out of here! I keep a respectable house and don't want any damned whores here!'" She goes on to describe the lady's shocked reaction to this reception and the horror with which one of them recognizes him as a family friend. Quote, "Walter Moffat," she exclaimed. "Can this be Walter Moffat? Why, Walter Moffat, I used to know you, and I prayed with your wife for your safety when you were at sea years ago."
"I don't want any of your damned prayers. I want you to get out of this and stay out. That's what I want of you. I don't keep a whorehouse."
Well, then, these are words that even today would earn a man a lusty punch on the mazzard from pretty much anyone in a position to deliver one, male or female. The fact that Moffat didn't get one on the spot can probably be chalked up to the utter improbability of his reaction, which was so far out of line with Victorian-era norms of how respectable women were supposed to be treated that the ladies were too flabbergasted to do anything but make their way back to the Taylor Street Church and tell their comrades-in-arms what had happened. By the way, I should also mention that Francis Fuller Victor in the original text does not actually write out the words damned and whores. They're the D followed by a long dash and W followed by a long dash. It is, I suppose, possible that those are different words, but I have assumed that they're damned and whores. Okay, continuing. Their story galvanized the congregation there. Outraged and furious, the ladies of the Temperance Crusade didn't realize that Moffat had given them a priceless gift. His treatment of his visitors was, to the Temperance Crusaders, what Pearl Harbor would one day be to the soldiers of the U.S. Army. It gave them a real, tangible, individual enemy to focus on. And focus on him they did. For weeks they tried to wear down his defenses by putting on daily appearances at his saloon, requesting entry, being denied, moving on. Finally, on the last day of March, they changed tactics. After being denied entry as usual, they lined up on the sidewalk and launched a prayer service right there outside the door. Moffat's response was almost as tone-deaf as his previous one had been. He emerged from his saloon wearing spectacles and holding himself with prim dignity, a copy of the Holy Bible in one hand. From this tome, he proceeded to read a selection of passages which, taken out of context, sounded wildly offensive. The only one of these specifically mentioned by the Crusaders is Deuteronomy 23:1, which reads, quote, "He that is wounded in the stones or hath his privy member cut off shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord." The ladies sang louder to drown him out. Moffat increased his own volume until he was actually shouting. This went on for some time, attracting, as you can imagine, a healthy crowd of spectators. Finally, the ladies moved on, but before they left, one of them tearfully asked Moffat why he was behaving like this. His bellicose response was that he minded his own business and expected others to mind theirs, and he called the Crusaders hypocrites. That evening, the ladies discussed Moffat at great length. Was he simply incorrigible, a waste of their time? Should they simply leave him on his road to hell and focus their attention on more salvageable souls? Or was his bizarre, erratic, and offensive behavior a subtle call for help? Strange as it sounds, the call for help theory is the one that carried the day. Some of the ladies argued that his strange behavior must stem from an uneasy conscience, and that that meant he was not beyond the reach of salvation. What Brother Moffat needed right now was not to be abandoned to his depravities and the blandishments of Satan, but rather to feel the tough, brave love of his true friends, who would be there to support his struggle for righteousness no matter how viciously he tried in his self-destructive demonic madness to drive them away. Looked at that way, leaving Walter Moffat alone would be a seriously sinful and selfish act, and one the ladies figured they'd be called to account for on Judgment Day. No, poor Brother Moffat would continue to receive his special treatment along with earnest and loving prayers for his salvation, whether he wanted them or not. In other words, Moffat's behavior had not only failed to persuade the ladies to leave him alone, it had put the full force of divine authority behind a mandate to continue pestering him, and the poor dolt clearly had no idea. Moffat continued to show the world his stunning lack of good judgment by hiring some thugs and buying and stockpiling some firecrackers for the ladies' next visit, which came the very next day. When they arrived, Moffat's goon squad went into action, beating big Chinese gongs in their faces and tossing lighted strings of firecrackers under their feet. It was another Rubicon crossed. Before this day, April Fool's Day, 1874, the only truly ungentlemanly behavior Moffat had engaged in had been a private conversation with two ladies with whom he was ejecting from his bar. Now, in front of the whole city, he and his thugs were not only being very disrespectful, they were putting the ladies in danger of a broken ankle or even immolation. Much of the clothing of the day was highly flammable. The crowd of onlookers was shocked. Then it started murmuring ominously and moving closer. The police, sensing that something ugly was about to happen, hurried in and persuaded the ladies to break off the engagement. The tone-deaf Mr. Moffat seems to have taken precisely the wrong lesson away from this episode. Spared from the consequences his tactics were about to bring down on his head, he concluded that they were exactly the ticket to get the ladies to leave him alone. The ladies gave him a week. Then they returned on April 7th. A force of 15 of them stationed themselves in front of the Webfoot and started singing and praying. Word spread like an electric current through Portland, and in minutes the crowd of onlookers was blocking streets and sidewalks and effectively shutting down the bar. Moffat, in a swift change of tactics, perhaps the gong beaters and firecracker throwers he'd hired had given up and gone home during the 7-day truce, got out his police whistle and started blasting on it, summoning Portland Police Chief Lapius, the part owner of the Orofino Saloon, remember, to the scene. Upon Lapius's arrival, Moffat demanded that he disperse the praying women. They were, he asserted, disturbing the peace by attracting an unruly crowd of onlookers. Oddly enough, it seems to have occurred to precisely no one to disperse the crowd of onlookers directly. Instead, Chief Lapius approached the ladies and asked them to leave. Respectfully, they declined. The chief told them that if they stuck around and a riot broke out, people could get hurt. Respectfully, they replied that that was up to God and to those people, and that they were just there to pray and sing. So Police Chief James Lapius arrested them. That's it for today. We'll have the conclusion to this story 1 week from today, and we'll find out how they fared in court and what subsequent action against the Webfoot Saloon had in store for the city of Portland, and how the whole temperance movement changed the subsequent elections. That's all coming at you on Thursday, November 29th. A few details to rattle off before I sign off here. Our central website is offbeatoregon.com if you'd like to check out the newspaper columns and photographs and maybe sign up for the RSS or iTunes feeds. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, written by Carmen Ficarra. You can reach me at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, @offbeatoregon, and I would love to hear from you. This podcast is under the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license, and details of that are at offbeatoregon.com/cc. Coming up tomorrow, our next episode in the Offbeat Oregon History Column series is going to be the just freshly out from under the embargo, a story that was published in September about Lotus Isle, the most surreal amusement park in the history of the state, probably the history of the country. it wasn't supposed to ever be built. It was started out as a swindle. They were going to try and shake down the Janssen Beach people by making a credible threat to build an amusement park there, hoping that Janssen Beach would buy them out. Janssen Beach didn't play, so they were forced to go ahead. I'll have that story for you after 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. In the meantime, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.